Okay, so you've got this speak test coming up, and it's covering a lot of ground pharmacologically, right? We're talking diabetes, meds, thyroid pituitary stuff, coagulation. Oh, and don't forget renal and fluids and electrolytes.
Yeah, it's a pretty broad swath of pharmacology for sure.
But think of this deep dive as like a targeted study session, right?
Right.
We've gone through tons of the material, YouTube transcripts, textbook excerpts, and we're going to pull out those key concepts for you.
Absolutely, yeah. And focus on those things that are, high yield for test taking.
Right. The mechanisms, how the drugs actually work when you use them, when you don't, those contraindications, and of course, what can go wrong, adverse effects, and those all important lab values you got to keep an eye on.
Yeah, monitoring those parameters is key in managing these conditions.
So let's start with diabetes, shall we? I mean,
Yeah.
just understanding the basics of diabetes mellitus is kind of fundamental here, right?
Right. Diabetes is all about elevated blood glucose,
Like too much sugar in the blood.
Exactly. And it's either because the body's just not producing enough insulin.
So that's where type 1 diabetes comes in, right?
Exactly. Type 1 is typically where those insulin-producing beta cells in the pancreas, they get destroyed. It's an autoimmune process.
And then there's type 2,
Right.
where the body becomes resistant to the insulin that is being produced.
Right. It's insulin resistance. And then often over time, you get a gradual decline in insulin production as well.
So it's like a double whammy in type 2.
Yeah, exactly. The cells just aren't responding to the insulin as well as they should. And on top of that, the pancreas may not be pumping out enough insulin to begin with.
So just a quick reminder for our listeners, think of insulin as the key.
It unlocks the door for glucose to enter cells for energy,
And without that key, that glucose just builds up in the bloodstream.
Exactly. And then you've got glucagon, which is kind of the opposite of insulin, right? It raises blood glucose by telling the liver to break down its stored glucose, glycogen.
Right, so when blood sugar gets too low, glucagon steps in to bring it back up.
It's a beautiful balancing act.
It is. And when that balance is off, we often need to bring in those reinforcements, right?
Right. Medications become a crucial part of managing blood sugar.
Okay, so let's dive into the different types of diabetes medications. We've got the injectables and the orals.
And within those categories, you have a wide range of different drug classes, each with its own unique mechanism of action.
Let's start with those injectables. First up, the big one, insulin itself and all those insulin
Insulin's a polypeptide, so it's a
analogs.
chain of amino acids, and if you took it orally, it would get broken down in the gut.
Like digested before it could even reach the bloodstream.
Exactly. So that's why we have to inject it subcutaneously, under the skin.
And it's amazing how we've got all these different types of insulin that act at different speeds and last for different durations.
It's all about matching the insulin profile to the individual's needs and lifestyle.
So we've got those rapid-acting insulins like Lispro, Aspart,
Those kick in pretty quickly, peak in about 30 minutes, and last for up to 5 hours or so.
Yeah, perfect for covering those mealtime spikes in blood sugar.
Exactly. And then there's regular insulin, which is a bit slower to peak.
Around 2 hours, and it hangs around for a bit longer, under 8 hours usually.
It's a good option for providing a bit more sustained coverage.
So what makes those rapid-acting ones so much faster? It has something to do with the structure of the insulin molecule, right?
Yeah. Normally, insulin molecules like to clump together in groups of six. They form these hexamers.
Like a little insulin posse?
Yeah, and these hexamers are too big to pass easily from the injection site into the bloodstream.
So they got to break down into individual insulin molecules first.
Exactly. Now, the brilliant thing about those rapid-acting insulin analogs is that they've been modified slightly, little tweaks to their amino acid sequences.
So they're like insulin 2.0.
Yeah, exactly. And these modifications make them less likely to form those bulky hexamers, so they're absorbed much more quickly.
So they get to work faster.
Right to that rapid onset of action that you need around mealtime.
Cool. Now, what about the intermediate-acting insulin, like NPH insulin?
Hmm.
It's slower to kick in, peaking around 6 hours and lasting for about 18 hours.
Yeah, NPH insulin is modified by adding zinc and protamine to regular insulin.
So it's like giving the insulin a little time-release coating.
Exactly. It forms this complex that's less soluble in the body, so it dissolves and absorbs more slowly from the injection site.
Making it last longer.
Right, prolonging its action.
And then we have those long-acting insulins, Dipyrimer, Glargine, Degludec.
These are designed to provide that steady background insulin coverage throughout the day.
Like a basal level of insulin.
Exactly. Didymur peaks around 6 to 8 hours, lasts up to 24 hours.
Glargine is interesting because it doesn't really have a peak, just this steady release over about 24 hours.
And Degludec can go even longer than 24 hours with no defined peak.
They each have their own unique ways of achieving this prolonged duration, don't they?
Yeah, they're all about those molecular modifications. Datamir has a fatty acid attached to it, so it binds to albumin in the bloodstream.
Albumin's like a taxi for the insulin, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Picks it up and releases it slowly over time. Glargine, on the other hand, is engineered to be less soluble at neutral pH.
So when you inject it, it forms these tiny precipitates.
Almost like microscopic crystals that slowly dissolve and release the insulin.
And D-glutec forms these long chains of hexamers, but they're super stable under the skin.
It's like a depot of insulin that's slowly and continuously absorbed.
It's incredible how they figured out all these different ways to fine-tune insulin action.
It's really revolutionized diabetes management.
Now, a key point for the test, and just in general, a major side effect of insulin is hypoglycemia, low blood sugar.
It's something everyone who uses insulin needs to be aware of and know how to manage.
Right, and the symptoms can range from mild, like feeling shaky or sweaty, to more severe, like confusion and even seizures.
Exactly. It's crucial to recognize the signs and take action quickly.
And are there any other notable side effects with insulin that might pop up on the test?
Yeah, one that's worth mentioning is lipodystrophy.
Which is basically changes in the fat tissue at the injection sites, right?
Right. You can get either lipoatrophy, where there's a loss of fat, or lipohypertrophy, where there's a buildup of fat.
And these changes can affect how insulin is absorbed.
Yeah, so it's super important to rotate those injection sites regularly.
Good advice. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to another injectable diabetes medication, pramlintide, which is a synthetic amylin.
Now, amylin is a naturally occurring hormone that's co-secreted with insulin from those pancreatic beta cells.
So it's like insulin's sidekick.
Yeah, and it has a few key roles. It slows down gastric emptying, meaning it slows down how quickly food empties from your stomach.
So that helps to prevent those rapid spikes in blood sugar after meals.
Exactly. It also suppresses glucagon release after you eat.
So it helps keep those blood sugar levels more stable.
Right. And it promotes a feeling of fullness or satiety.
So you feel more satisfied after eating.
Which can be helpful for weight management.
Now, pramlintide, being a synthetic analog of amylin, it basically mimics these actions, right?
Exactly. It can help to reduce the amount of insulin a patient needs, which is a big plus.
But it still carries a risk of hypoglycemia, especially when used with insulin.
Yeah, because it does affect glucose regulation, so that's something to be mindful of.
And are there any other common side effects that might show up on the test?
Yeah, nausea is a fairly common one, and some folks experience modest weight loss, which can be a bonus for some.
Okay, last of the injectables, the incretin mimetics, like exenatide and liraglutide.
These are a fascinating class of medications.
They work by mimicking the action of incretins, which are hormones that are released from your gut when you eat.
Incretins are like the body's own signal to the pancreas to ramp up insulin production.
Like, hey, we've got food coming and time to release some insulin.
Exactly. The two main incretins are GLP-1, that's glucagon-like peptide 1, and GIP, glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide.
But these incretins have a pretty short lifespan in the body, right?
Yeah, they get broken down rapidly by an enzyme called DPP-4 dipeptidyl peptidase 4.
So the GLP-1 mimetics, like exenatide and liraglutide, they're designed to resist this breakdown.
Exactly. They hang around longer and have a more prolonged effect.
So they boost insulin secretion, but they do more than that, right?
Right. In addition to stimulating insulin release, they also slow down gastric emptying, which helps with those post-meal glucose spikes.
And they promote satiety.
Often leading to weight loss, which can be another benefit.
What about side effects? Any common ones to be aware of?
Yeah, mostly gastrointestinal stuff, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, that kind of thing.
Okay. And there's been some talk about a potential increased risk of pancreatitis with these drugs.
Yeah, it's something that's still being investigated, but it's worth mentioning.
Okay, so that's a good overview of those injectable diabetes meds. Now let's move on to the oral anti-diabetic agents.
We've got quite a few different classes here, each with its own unique way of targeting blood sugar.
First up, the DPP-4 inhibitors, like eloglipton, linagliptin, saxagliptin, sitagliptin.
Yeah, these are all about inhibiting that DPP-4 enzyme that we talked about.
So they prevent the breakdown of those natural incretins, GLP-1 and GIP.
Exactly, leading to higher levels of those hormones in the body.
Which then enhances insulin secretion, decreases glucagon release, and slows down gastric emptying.
It's all about amplifying the body's own mechanisms for regulating blood sugar.
Any common side effects that we should know about?
Yeah, some of the common ones are similar to those GLP-1 mimetics we talked about, like nasopharyngitis, you know, a stuffy nose and sore throat.
Okay, and headache is another one that's frequently reported.
Right. Those are definitely things to keep in mind.
Okay, next up, A class of drugs that has been around for a while, the sulfonylureas.
Yeah, good old sulfonylureas like glimepiride, glibride, glipizide.
These work by directly stimulating insulin release from those pancreatic beta cells, right?
They're like a kick in the pants for the beta cells, telling them to pump out more insulin.
And how do they achieve this?
They work by blocking these channels on the beta cell membrane called ATP-sensitive potassium channels.
These channels are involved in the process of insulin secretion, right?
Right, exactly. So normally when blood glucose rises, the beta cells start metabolizing that glucose, and that leads to an increase in ATP levels inside the cell.
ATP is like the energy currency of the cell.
Right, and when ATP levels go up, these potassium channels close, and that causes the cell membrane to become more electrically charged. It depolarizes.
This is like flipping a switch.
And this depolarization then leads to an influx of calcium ions, which triggers the release of insulin.
So the sulfonylureas, they basically bypass the need for glucose and directly block those potassium channels.
They force the beta cells to secrete more insulin, whether blood sugar is high or not.
Which is why hypoglycemia is a major concern with this class of drugs.
Right, because they can keep pushing insulin out even when blood sugar is already low.
And weight gain is another common side effect.
Yeah, that can be a drawback for some folks.
Now, sulfonylureas can also interact with a lot of other medications, right?
Yeah, they're highly bound to proteins in the blood, and they're metabolized by enzymes in the liver, specifically the cytochrome P450 system.
So there's a lot of potential for drug interactions.
Exactly, which can either affect how well the sulfonylureas work or increase the risk of side effects.
Yeah, definitely something to be mindful of. Now, similar to sulfonylureas, we've got the glionides like nadaglionide and repaglionide.
Yeah, these are also insulin secretagogues, meaning they stimulate insulin release from the beta cells.
They also work on those ATP-sensitive potassium channels, right?
They do, but they bind to a different site on the channel, and they have a faster onset of action and a shorter duration of effect compared to sulfonylureas.
Oh, yeah. So they're like the quick-acting version.
Exactly. They're particularly good for managing postprandial hyperglycemia.
Meaning those blood sugar spikes that happen right after meals?
You can take them shortly before eating, and they help to blunt that rise in blood sugar.
Okay. Side effects? Same concerns as sulfonylureas.
Pretty much. Yeah, hypoglycemia and weight gain are the main ones. But some studies suggest the risk might be a bit lower than with sulfonylureas.
All right, moving on to a very popular one, metformin, which is a big one-eyed.
It's often the first-line treatment for type 2 diabetes.
Now, its mechanism is a bit of a mystery, isn't it?
Yeah, the exact details of how it works at the cellular level are still being worked out.
But we know that its main action is to reduce hepatic glucose production.
It basically tells the liver to chill out on pumping out so much glucose.
It also slows down glucose absorption in the gut and increases insulin sensitivity.
So it's working on multiple fronts to improve blood sugar control.
Side effects, what are the common ones?
The most frequent complaints are gastrointestinal, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, loss of appetite.
But the good news is, these often get better over time.
Yeah, and some folks even experience some weight loss, which can be a nice perk.
Now, there's one serious warning associated with metformin that we need to mention.
Right, the risk of lactic acidosis.
Which is a buildup of lactic acid in the body.
Yeah, it's a rare but potentially serious complication.
And the risk is higher in people with kidney or liver problems or heart failure.
Right, because those conditions can affect the body's ability to clear lactate.
So it's definitely something to be aware of. Okay, next we have the thiazolidinones, or TZDs like pioglitazone and rosiglitazone.
These work in a completely different way than the other oral agents we've talked about.
They target a nuclear receptor called PPAR-gamma, right?
Exactly. Peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a big name, but it's basically a receptor that's found inside the nucleus of cells.
And when it's activated, it affects the expression of certain genes that are involved in glucose and lipid metabolism and insulin signaling.
It's like flipping a bunch of genetic switches to improve insulin sensitivity and reduce glucose production.
So they increase insulin sensitivity in fat cells, muscle, and the liver, and they also decrease glucose production by the liver.
Right. They're working on multiple levels to improve glucose homeostasis.
Now, what about those side effects?
Yeah. TZDs can cause weight gain, often due to fluid retention and increased fat tissue.
And that fluid retention can also lead to peripheral edema.
You know, swelling in the ankles and legs.
Pioglitazone specifically is known to increase HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol.
That's a potential benefit. And while TZDs might also increase LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, it tends to be the larger, less atherogenic LDL particles.
Meaning they're less likely to contribute to plaque buildup in the arteries.
But rare cases of hepatotoxicity or liver damage have also been reported.
So liver function tests need to be monitored.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, moving on to another relatively new class of oral agents, the SGLT2 inhibitors like canagliflozin and dapagliflozin.
These work in a pretty unique way, right?
Yeah, they target the kidneys, specifically those proximal convoluted tubules of the nephron, which is the functional unit of the kidney.
They basically tell the kidneys to excrete more glucose in the urine.
Right. They inhibit this protein called SGLT2, sodium glucose cotransporter 2, which is responsible for reabsorbing glucose from the filtrate back into the bloodstream.
So by blocking SGLT2, more glucose ends up in the pee and less in the blood.
And this increased glucose in the urine can actually have a mild diuretic effect as well, pulling some extra water with it.
Leading to a slight reduction in blood pressure and maybe even a bit of weight loss.
Yeah, it's kind of a bonus effect.
Now, side effects, what are the common ones for these drugs?
Well, since you're peeing out more sugar, that can create a breeding ground for bacteria and yeast.
So increased thirst and urination are common.
And there's a higher risk of UTIs, urinary tract infections, and genital yeast infections.
Okay, good to know. And last but not least, in the oral category, we've got the alpha-glucosidase inhibitors like acarbose and miglitol.
These work by targeting carbohydrate digestion.
They inhibit the enzyme alpha-glucosidase, which is found in the brush border of the small intestine.
That's where a lot of nutrient absorption happens.
Alpha-glucosidase is responsible for breaking down complex carbs like starches and sugars into simple sugars like glucose.
So by inhibiting this enzyme, you slow down carbohydrate breakdown and absorption.
So it helps to lower that postprandial glucose spike that you get after eating.
Right. It flattens that curve.
No, what's the catch?
Well, the catch is that those undigested carbs, they make their way down to the lower parts of the intestine.
And the bacteria down there have a field day.
Leading to a whole lot of gas, bloating, cramps, and diarrhea.
So GI side effects are a major issue with these drugs.
Yeah, for a lot of people, those side effects are just too much to handle.
Okay, that was a marathon, but we made it through the diabetes medications.
That was quite a rundown.
Now let's shift gears and talk about thyroid and pituitary disorders.
Another fascinating area of endocrinology.
But before we jump into the medications, we need a quick refresher on the roles of the hypothalamus and pituitary glands.
Right. These are the master regulators of the endocrine system.
They control so many hormonal functions throughout the body.
The pituitary is often called the master gland, but it's really under the control of the hypothalamus.
It's like the puppet master pulling the strings.
Exactly. The hypothalamus sends signals to the pituitary, which then releases hormones that act on other glands and tissues throughout the body.
Now, the pituitary has two main parts. The anterior pituitary and the posterior pituitary.
And they function a little differently.
So the anterior pituitary, it actually produces and secretes its own hormones.
In response to signals from the hypothalamus.
And those signals come in the form of hypothalamic releasing hormones.
Right. So you've got TRH thyrotropin releasing hormone, which tells the pituitary to release TSH thyroid stimulating hormone.
And then there's GnRH gonadotropin releasing hormone, which stimulates the release of LH and FSH luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone.
Those are the key players in reproductive function.
And CRH corticotropin releasing hormone stimulates the release of ACTH adrenocorticotropic hormone, which acts on the adrenal glands.
And GHRH, growth hormone releasing hormone, well, it does exactly what its name suggests.
Tells the pituitary to release growth hormone.
Exactly. And then you've also got some inhibiting hormones from the hypothalamus, like GHIH, growth hormone inhibiting hormone, which is also known as somatostatin.
That one puts the brakes on growth hormone release.
And then there's PIH, prolactin inhibiting hormone, which is actually dopamine.
And as its name suggests, it inhibits the secretion of prolactin.
It's all about that intricate balance between stimulating and inhibiting hormones.
Okay, so that's the anterior pituitary. What about the posterior pituitary? It's got a more direct connection to the hypothalamus, right?
Yeah, the posterior pituitary doesn't produce hormones itself. It just stores and releases hormones that are actually made in the hypothalamus.
So it's like a storage depot.
Exactly. The two main hormones released from the posterior pituitary are ADH antidiuretic hormone, also known as vasopressin, and oxytocin.
ADH is all about regulating water balance, right?
Exactly. It acts on the kidneys to tell them to conserve water.
And oxytocin, well, it's famous for its roles in labor and breastfeeding.
It stimulates uterine contractions during labor and milk ejection during breastfeeding.
Okay, so now let's zero in on the thyroid gland. How are those crucial thyroid hormones actually made in the body?
Well, it all starts with this protein called thyroglobulin, which is produced by the follicular cells of the thyroid gland.
And these follicular cells, they form these little spheres called follicles.
And inside those follicles, there's this gel-like substance called colloid.
So the thyroglobulin is secreted into the colloid.
And then iodine, which we get from our diet, is actively taken up by the follicular cells and transported into the colloid as well.
Iodine is essential for making thyroid hormone.
Absolutely. Now, there's this key enzyme called thyroid peroxidase, or TPO, that does a couple of important things.
TPO is like the master chef of thyroid hormone synthesis.
It oxidizes iodide to iodine, and then it attaches those iodine molecules to tyrosine residues on the thyroglobulin molecule.
Tyrosine is an amino acid that's part of the thyroglobulin structure.
Right. So this process of attaching iodine to tyrosine is called iodination.
And then these iodinated tyrosines, they get coupled together.
You can have two DITs, diiodotyrosines, combining to form T4 thyroxine, which has four iodine atoms.
Or you can have one MIT monoiodotyrosine combining with one DIT for T3 triiodothyronine, which has three iodine atoms.
And T3 is the more active form of thyroid hormone.
Okay, so now we've got T4 and T3 attached to this big thyroglobulin molecule. What happens next?
Well, when the body needs thyroid hormone, the thyroglobulin with its attached T4 and T3 is taken back into the follicular cells.
Like endocytosis, the cell engulfs the thyroglobulin.
And then inside the cell, enzymes break down the thyroglobulin, releasing free T4 and T3 into the bloodstream.
So now the hormones are free to circulate throughout the body.
Right. And most of them actually bind to carrier proteins in the blood.
So they're like little hormone shuttles.
Exactly. And then when they reach their target cells, T4 can be converted to the more active T3 by enzymes called deiodinases.
Deiodinases, they basically remove an iodine atom from T4 to make T3.
There are different types of deiodinases. Some activate thyroid hormone and some inactivate it.
So it's like a fine-tuning system.
Exactly. And then finally, T3 enters the nucleus of the target cell and binds to thyroid hormone receptors.
And that's where the magic happens.
It regulates the expression of specific genes leading to all the various effects of thyroid hormone.
Wow, that's a pretty intricate process.
It is, but it's fascinating how all these steps are so tightly regulated.
Okay, so now let's talk about what happens when this system goes awry. First up, hypothyroidism, where the thyroid gland isn't producing enough thyroid hormone.
Hypothyroidism can really slow down the body's metabolism, leading to fatigue, weight gain, cold intolerance, all sorts of symptoms.
So the main treatment is to replace the missing thyroid hormone, right?
Exactly. We've got a few different options available, including levothyroxine, which is synthetic T4.
That's the most commonly prescribed one.
Yeah, it's generally well tolerated and effective.
And then there's liothyronine, which is synthetic T3.
That one has a faster onset of action, but it also has a shorter half-life, so it needs to be taken more frequently.
We also have Liotrix, which is a combo product containing both T4 and T3.
And then there's desiccated natural thyroid, which is derived from animal thyroid glands, usually pigs.
So it contains both T4 and T3, but also some other thyroid-related compounds.
It's been used for a long time, but it's not as standardized as the synthetic versions.
Okay, what about the opposite situation, hyperthyroidism, where the thyroid gland is overproducing thyroid hormone?
That can lead to a whole different set of problems like rapid heartbeat, weight loss, anxiety, heat intolerance.
So how do we rein in that overactive thyroid?
Well, the main medications we use are antithyroid drugs like propylthiouracil or PTU and methimazole.
And these drugs, they basically block thyroid hormone synthesis, right?
They work by inhibiting thyroid peroxidase, that key enzyme we talked about earlier.
So they prevent the oxidation of iodide and the coupling of those iodotyrosines. So less T4 and T3 are produced.
And PTU has an extra trick up its sleeve. It also inhibits the conversion of T4 to T3 in the peripheral tissues.
So it can provide a more rapid effect in certain situations.
It's a useful option in some cases.
All right, let's touch on another class of drugs that affects the hypothalamic pituitary axis. The GnRH analogs.
These are interesting because they can either stimulate or suppress the release of LH and FSH.
It depends on how they're used, right?
Exactly. So the GnRH agonists like gosserilin, histrulin, leuprolide, neferrilin, they initially stimulate LH and FSH release.
But with prolonged use, they actually desensitize the pituitary gland,
leading to a suppression of LH and FSH.
It's like tricking the pituitary into shutting down.
Exactly. And then you have the GnRH antagonists like Degarelix, Elagolix, Ganirelix, Cetrorelix.
These guys just directly block the GnRH receptor in the pituitary,
leading to an immediate suppression of LH and FSH.
So they're like putting a stop sign right at the receptor.
Yeah, they're more of a direct approach.
So these GnRH analogs, they're used in a lot of different conditions, right?
Yeah, they're used in certain types of cancers like prostate cancer and some breast cancers.
And also in various gynecological disorders like endometriosis and uterine fibroids.
They can also be used in fertility treatments.
Yeah, we have preparations of LH and FSH themselves, like metatropins, urofalotropin, palotropin, and choriogonadotropin alpha.
Those can be used to stimulate spermatogenesis in men and ovulation in women.
Okay, now what about medications that affect the adrenal cortex?
Yeah, the adrenal glands are crucial for producing a variety of hormones, including cortisol and aldosterone.
And ACTH from the pituitary tells the adrenal cortex to get to work right.
Exactly. ACTH stimulates the synthesis of all those adrenocortical hormones.
So if someone has Addison's disease, where the adrenal cortex isn't producing enough hormones,
we need to replace those missing hormones.
Typically with fludrocortisone to replace aldosterone and hydrocortisone, or prednisone to replace cortisol.
Aldosterone is important for regulating blood pressure and electrolytes.
And cortisol has a wide range of effects on metabolism, stress response, immune function.
It's a vital hormone.
Now, on the flip side, if someone has Cushing's syndrome where there's too much cortisol,
we need to suppress cortisol production.
And we can do that with medications like ketoconazole, mitotane, and metirapone.
These drugs inhibit specific enzymes involved in cortisol synthesis.
So they basically put a damper on cortisol production.
It's all about restoring that hormonal balance.
Okay, next up, growth hormone. GHRH and ghrelin stimulate its release, leading to IGF-1 secretion and growth.
It's a complex interplay of hormones.
So if someone has growth hormone deficiency,
we can treat them with synthetic somatotropin, which is basically a recombinant human growth hormone.
Or in cases of severe IGF-1 deficiency, we can use mecosermin, which is recombinant human IGF-1.
That can help to stimulate growth in those who aren't responding to growth hormone alone.
Now, what about when there's too much growth hormone?
That can lead to gigantism in children or acromegaly in adults.
So how do we manage that?
Somatostatin analogs like octreotide and lanreotide are the mainstay of treatment.
Somatostatin is a naturally occurring hormone that inhibits growth hormone release.
So these analogs mimic its action and help to lower GH levels.
Like putting the brakes on growth hormone overproduction.
Exactly. All right, moving on to prolactin, another pituitary hormone that's primarily regulated by dopamine.
Dopamine inhibits its release.
So if someone has hyperprolactinemia, meaning high prolactin levels,
you can treat them with dopamine agonists like bromocriptine and cabergoline.
These drugs mimic the action of dopamine and suppress prolactin secretion.
And if there's not enough prolactin,
we can use a dopamine antagonist like metoclopramide,
which blocks dopamine's inhibitory effects and leads to an increase in prolactin.
It's all about manipulating those dopamine pathways.
Okay, last stop on our pituitary tour. The posterior pituitary hormones, ADH, vasopressin, and oxytocin.
These are essential for fluid balance and some other key functions.
So for issues related to ADH, we have desmopressin, which is a selective V2 receptor agonist.
V2 receptors are primarily found in the kidneys, and they mediate ADH's antidiuretic effect.
So desmopressin is used to treat central diabetes insipidus, where the body's not making enough ADH.
And it's also used for certain bleeding disorders and bedwetting.
Now, if there's too much ADH, like in SIADH syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone secretion,
we use vasopressin receptor antagonists like conavaptan and tolvaptan.
Those block the effects of ADH and promote water excretion.
Exactly. And for oxytocin, well, we use the synthetic form to induce labor and control postpartum bleeding.
It's amazing how these hormones and their synthetic counterparts can be used to manage such a wide range of conditions.
It really speaks to the power of pharmacology.
Okay, let's switch gears again and talk about drugs that affect coagulation, the process of blood clotting.
This is a really intricate system that's essential for preventing bleeding, but also for preventing unwanted clots.
It's a delicate balancing act.
Exactly. Coagulation involves a complex cascade of clotting factors, which are proteins that activate each other in a specific sequence.
It's like a domino effect.
Yeah, culminating in the formation of fibrin, which is a tough fibrous protein that forms the structural framework of a blood clot.
And there are two main pathways that can kick off this cascade: the intrinsic and extrinsic pathways.
But they both converge on a common pathway that leads to fibrin production.
And the body also has a system for breaking down clots when they're no longer needed, the fibrinolytic system.
This system involves the conversion of plasminogen to plasmin, which is an enzyme that degrades fibrin.
So it's like the cleanup crew for blood clots.
Exactly. Now, when this delicate balance is disrupted, we can use medications to either prevent clots or break them down.
So let's start with the anticoagulants. These are the drugs that prevent clot formation.
They're used in a lot of different conditions where there's an increased risk of clots like atrial fibrillation after certain types of surgery, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism.
And they work by inhibiting different parts of the coagulation cascade.
So let's break down the different types. We've got heparin, warfarin, and then those newer direct thrombin inhibitors and direct factor XA inhibitors.
Okay, first up, heparin. How does it work and what kind of monitoring do we need to do?
So heparin binds to this protein in the blood called antithrombin III.
Antithrombin III is like a natural clot buster.
Yeah, and heparin basically supercharges it. It enhances antithrombin's ability to inhibit several key clotting factors like thrombin and factor XA.
Now, unfractionated heparin, it can be a little unpredictable in terms of its effect.
So we need to monitor its activity using the APTT activated partial thromboplastin time.
That's a blood test that measures how long it takes for blood to clot.
Right. And we usually adjust the heparin dose based on the APTT results.
Now, there's a potential complication with heparin that we need to be aware of, heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, or HIT.
It's a drop in the platelet count that can be caused by heparin.
And there are two types.
Yeah. Type one is...